You are listening to Sid Weighs In. We're a Tuck School business professor, associate dean for executive education, and an expert on strategy and leadership. Sidney Finkelstein shares his views on what leaders are doing, why they are doing it, and whether it makes sense for them and for you.
This is Sidney Finkelstein, and welcome to another edition of Sid Weighs In, the podcast where I talk about a recent BBC column with a guest host. And today our guest host is Charles Christensen. Hi, Charles.
Thanks for having me, Professor Finkelstein.
It's great to have you here. But, you know, one of the rules is, because it is called Sid Weighs In, you got to call me Sid.
I was just going to ask, you know, here we are. You know, we're not in the classroom, so I will do this. But I promise when we're out of here, I'll revert right back to Professor Finkelstein.
As you wish. this is a topic that today for the podcast that is quite apropos for what's going on. And that is, of course, the Sochi Olympics, which are starting actually right now, even as we're recording. Is that right?
I think that's right. I think the opening ceremonies are happening as we speak. And one of the things that I appreciate you having me on here today is my background of being a professional athlete. This time of year is always special to me, and also being a winter sports athlete, this is particularly one time where I really pay extra attention to the television.
So share a little bit about your background, Charles.
Sure. Well, not quite from the woods of Hanover, but also I am from the woods of Anchorage, Alaska, born and raised there, and as a professional skier, graduating college before I sustained a couple injuries. Skiing, as you know, is quite a dangerous sport, but I was lucky enough to get admittance here into Tuck, and so I'm learning about the business side of all things, including sports and competition, and this is why it's such an exciting topic to talk about.
So do you actually know some of the skiers competing for the U.S. team right now?
I do indeed. In fact, I would probably say, you know, skiing is a relatively small sport as the higher you go up in the rankings, and so I'm familiar with all of them, and I also stay connected as the United States Ski Association Alpine rep. So I'm actually their athlete rep on the board of directors.
Right, and you are also, of course, a first year Tuck student.
I am also a first year Tuck student, and I would say that the first year Tuck student, the schedule has put plenty of things on us, and so it's fun to balance the two.
Right, absolutely. Well, the column today is actually not just about skiing and not just about the Olympics. It's about competition, something
right.
You've lived and breathed. And actually, how old were you when you started, Charles?
I started skiing when I was about 3 years old, and I entered my first race when I was six because I had an older brother, and he was 4 years older, so if he was doing it, I was definitely doing it.
Isn't it always that way? It's fantastic.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and did he stick with it all the years too?
He did not. I carried it farther than he did, and I actually have a little brother who is, sadly to say, better than I am, so he is carrying the torch as we speak.
There is no justice.
No.
Okay, well, today the column is called... and we're really going to go off of sports with the beginning of it. What coffee baristas, ice hockey, and comedy shows can teach us about competition. A new barista at my local coffee shop pulled a wonderful ristretto cappuccino the other day. When I told her it was almost as good as the one the more experienced baristas make, she seemed actually a little disappointed. The next day it was even better, which, of course, I noted. The new barista's reaction, it'll be perfect next time. People are driven by competition in every walk of life. From babies to the elderly, from Canada to Australia, and from my local cafe to Wall Street. Yes, the intensity varies from person to person, in part based on the domains in which they exercise their competitive muscle, but the competitive spirit is central to who we are as human beings. As the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia are upon us, let's take a look at competition. What does it mean for strategic thinking and motivating talent in organizations, and what does it mean for each of us? Do you know anyone who looks at the world as us versus them? Well, I do. This person is always scheming to get ahead. He doesn't just want to win. He wants the other guy to lose. You almost have to check your wallet when you leave his office. For some people, that is the definition of competition. And you know what? It's not that hard to see why. Take ice hockey, popular at the Winter Olympics. And actually, I'm a Canadian myself, and so ice hockey is in my DNA. And I'll tell you the truth, even though here in the U.S. for all these years, I will be rooting for the Canadian hockey team.
As you should.
There you go. So, ice hockey. One team wins and one team loses. I mean, your team can't win unless the other team loses. When this attitude moves from the ice to the office, you get Larry Ellison, the famous CEO of global computer technology company Oracle, is well known for his axiom, it's not enough to succeed, everyone else must fail. What happens, though, when you start taking more joy in someone else's loss than in your win? Sound crazy? I wonder if this logic is behind hyper-aggressive cost-cutting in retail. In truth, when prices fall, everyone loses because profits are squeezed and consumers begin to expect all those lower prices. Nevertheless, retailers still cling to the practice in hopes that eventually they alone will survive, and then they can push prices up. Isn't this what the stock market has been betting on when it comes to Amazon? The company books losses or marginal profits year after year, and yet the company's stock keeps moving up. This also brings to mind the famous loss aversion hypothesis of Nobel Prize-winning psychologists Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. Their experiments demonstrated that most people hate to lose more than they like to win. As a result, we don't sell losing stock investments when we should. It could always go up, we tell ourselves. We don't give up on failing pet projects as quickly as we might. Maybe Microsoft's Bing search engine being an example. And we are less likely to return clothes we order online, presumably because once it arrives in your home, sending it back means we're actually giving something up, a loss. Worth remembering, however, is that the act of competing very often does make us better. College basketball teams tend to do better in tournaments when they play more difficult teams beforehand. It toughens you up. Industries like consulting and banking have their own version of this. They've created an up-and-out system that requires you to perform well relative to the other people around you. Many jobs raise the bar even further. Not only must you compete with colleagues to get ahead, you have to also cooperate with them. Sounds like a paradox, but consider the consulting industry. People work in teams, meaning cooperation is required to accomplish tasks. Yet it's not the team that gets promoted, but the individual. My favorite example of this phenomenon is in the ensemble variety shows such as the comedy stalwart Saturday Night Live, SNL, in the U.S. To get a spot on the weekly show, writers and actors on SNL must create skits together. That's cooperation. But there are also way more skits than there is time available. That, of course, is competition. The best people must learn to simultaneously cooperate and compete with colleagues. The net-net of this is that SNL has become a launching pad for talent in the comedy business. Now, what of our barista at the local cafe? When we talked some more about making espresso, and yes, I do like coffee a lot, it became clear that her desire to get better was driven less by trying to one-up the established baristas and more by her internal need to excel. She was testing herself. She found herself falling short, and she vowed to improve. Of all the flavors of competition, this is the most powerful one of all. Competition that is self, and I'll be very interested, Charles, if you agree with that, because you have competed at a very high level.
Mm-hmm.
Competition that is self-contained, where you're driven to work, to accomplish, and to exceed what you've done before, simply because you want to. Your internal motivation and commitment are much more powerful than external competition. The 18-year-old American Olympic skiing sensation Michaela Schifrin has been described as a, quote, once-in-a-lifetime talent by her Austrian-born coach. In fact, winning 6 World Cup slalom races in the last year while competing in a sport where most women peak at age 27. When interviewed, she asserts improbably that it is not simply winning a race that motivates her. Instead, she says, quote, I can honestly say that I am motivated by improvement, not results. Well, none of us might have the incredible talent of Schifrin, that's for sure, but we can all absorb this lesson. When you're internally motivated to always get better, you end up winning a lot more than you lose. What do you think about that, Charles?
Yeah, you know, Sid, I really think that this is a driving force behind a lot of athletes. When a lot of people hear Bodie Miller speak, another skier, he talks about always the search for the perfect run and how, you know, in a sport that is measured by hundredths of a second, you know, there could be a gust of wind that sort of determines whether or not you win or lose. And I think about an interview recently that Bodie gave, quoting Vince Lombardi, who said famously, "Winning isn't everything; it's the only thing."
Right, right.
That really doesn't stand up to him, and he explained why. That, you know, when Nancy Kerrigan was famously
Nancy Kerrigan, 20 years ago in the Olympics, that's who you're talking about?
Absolutely, yeah. The very famous example of the ice skater who was, accosted and had Tanya Harding, as it was later found out, was responsible for hiring hitmen to take her out in the Olympics.
Unbelievable. Let's hope that's not going to happen in the next 2 weeks in Sochi.
That is why Lair Ellison doesn't play sports, apparently, on the Olympic level. One of the things, though, was the point that Bodie was making was that he was saying that if I got third place, but the first, second place and first place were taken out with bats, that's not winning. What's important to me is that I ski the best run that's possible. And so I really think that this internal motivation comes through in what he's saying, and it really drives a lot of athletes to excel.
You used the word perfection, and I'm sure I'm going to write a column about that topic soon, because people are always talking about that. And there's such a beauty to perfection, maybe in part because you actually never get there. I mean, I remember we used to have in ice skating, a system where you can go up to 6.0. Was that? And that was also in gymnastics, I think.
Uh-huh.
So yep. I guess technically there was something called perfection. But to actually get perfection, there's always something that's better. Think about the Olympics. Year after year, there's always someone who does something better. It's incredible. But the quest for perfection is such a beautiful thing.
It's true. And absolutely. And I think one of the beauties of sports is it allows people to sort of witness in a very visual way the limits of the human potential. And through that, people are seeking perfection. And, you know, like you said, we see it eclipsed year after year, but we remember those moments, those special moments time and again of when we saw what we consider is either maybe not perfection, but the most perfect that someone has been in a certain situation.
Right, right. Now, let's bring it into the world of work. You know, perfection can be a very dangerous thing because it means you never let go of your project, you never get more feedback, you're having trouble kind of finalizing a project. You don't give up on failing projects. I'm thinking about, you know, drug discovery process.
Absolutely.
And so, on the one hand, perfection is really the enemy of kind of good management. On the other hand, I don't really want to let go of it entirely, right?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the things that I've really learned here while at business school, and I am just a first-year student, so what the heck do I know? But, you know, there's so many different metrics. In a ski race, I'm allowed very easily to quantify my experience and how I did on one result page. Here, there's so many different metrics. I mean, you have your relationship with your coworkers. You have whether or not the people that you presumably were doing work with accepted your work or not. Those are just two examples of, you know, plenty of different ways where you could have won or lost a certain situation. So I think that evaluating it on a bunch of different spectrums makes it more a complicated event when you apply that to the business world.
That's great, Charles. Any other things come to mind as you think about this topic?
Yeah, actually one does. When I think about maybe not perfection, might be, you know, without being too ironic, too fine of a point, mm-hmm. I think success is something that really is translatable between sports and the business world. Both situations I've found that by investing into the details and really knowing either your product or the environment of which you compete in, so to speak, that's where I think people find the most success. And I can give you one small little story. Michaela Schifrin, as you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. Before her second run when she was 18 last year, she was world champion in the slalom event in Schladming, Austria. I had the opportunity to be there. And I got to have dinner with her that night, and everybody asked her around the dinner table, said, Michaela, what was it in that second run? You were in third place after the first run, and in a two-run event, you had to make vast gains in the second run, and really, you know, how did you do that to capture the gold? And she said, I looked around, I knew my skiing was fine, but I noticed that the best competitor, Tina Maze, she had chapped lips, and if her lips are chapped at the start of the race, that means that she's dehydrated and she was probably stressing out. I've never in my life have looked at people's
lips. Was she serious? I mean, she was completely serious about that?
She was completely.
She was picking up that type of nuance. And how old?
She's 18. She had yet to graduate high school at this point.
Let's get her into the tuck school ASAP.
I think that she could be fast-tracked here in a second. Yeah, no problem. But, you know, it's that attention to detail that I think applies in kind of every environment that you want. And, you know, perfection or not, that those things can't help but breed success.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. Well, let's look forward to a great Olympics. And Charles, it's great to have you here as guest host.
Thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun.
This has been Sid Wazin. If you would like to comment on this podcast, follow Professor Finkelstein on Twitter @SidFinkelstein, #SidWazin. Thank you for listening.